Hello and welcome to the Zeitgeist 19 podcast, curating the spirit of now through the lens of art and sustainability. Your hosts are Farah Piriya-Cohen and Elizabeth Zhivkova. In this episode, we are joined by Daniela Zeman, curator, writer, and artistic director of TBA 21 Academy, an institution at the forefront of oceanic and ecological thinking in contemporary art. Daniela has spent years pushing the boundaries of cultural practice, turning museums and exhibitions into spaces for planetary inquiry and transdisciplinary dialogue. We talk about her book The Laughter of the Jellyfish, where she introduces the radical notions of counter-research and counter-knowledge, frameworks that challenge how we produce and validate information, especially in the context of deep ecological and epistemic crisis. Through reflections on jellyfish as figures of non-human intelligence, and with reference to a host of transdisciplinary artists, we ask, what role can artists play in reshaping our visions of the future? How can culture intervene in science and policymaking? And what might the ocean still have to teach us if only we learn to listen?
Welcome, Daniela. It is such an honor to have you as a guest at As Above, So Below series. As artistic director of TBA 21, how do you see the role of culture in shaping science and policy today? What is your perspective on its current place in the world, and what lies at the core of your practice and commitment?
Well, thank you first for the invitation. Thanks for the questions. Thank you for paying attention to my practice as well and to my book that I'm very honored to be sharing with you some thoughts about. Well, your question is really a very deep one and quite difficult one. And let me try to unravel it a bit for us and for our listeners. So I am very worried, and I think not alone, that we're really living in a very difficult moment, one that demands, I would say, both reckoning and a realigning. No? We see everywhere that what we call the green agenda, no? That was once carried by green parties that are now very much in decline, are further eroding by a dark and very conservative and authoritarian backlash. Now, we have had many movements, many civic movements like Fridays for Future, Extinction Rebellion. Many of them have really lost their momentum. Yeah? And so what I would call the civic energies for climate, health and justice have really been worn down lately, or are being deliberately, I would say, dismantled. Yeah? We have, and we're facing, rising nationalist forces that dismiss ecology simply, you know, saying that they're elitist, academic, they're detached from the real life struggles of people. And that is a problem. No? At the same time, what we called the European Green Transition is risking to be stillborn, smothered in division and distrust. Furthermore, environmental programs on a national level are being literally slashed everywhere. And even the most liberal politics are retreating from planetary responsibility. So in a way, we're witnessing how volatile, how difficult this idea of transition is. Now we've been using this, the green transition, the idea of transitioning into, let's say, a sort of a post-carbon future. But not only post-carbon future, but also transitions in different technological tools that we're using. But so this idea of transition is creating sort of many disruptions, and especially in a situation that I would call a rolling catastrophe. And any shift in political and economical direction is very easily weaponized. And I think that's a part of the catastrophe as well. And I'm recalling here the very last kind of public project that Bruno Latour has led and curated. And basically what he said at the time is that we're no longer arguing over how to live on one planet, but we behave as if we lived on different planets altogether. No? So he was basically pointing at the fact that we're not only living through political disagreements, but he said they are ontological wars. And so that's very important for us to also remember. And these ontological wars, these wars of different ways of being that he diagnosed, makes our current moment even more dangerous. Because what we are facing is not only an ecological crisis, it is, in a certain way, a civilizational one. And it touches really on everything. It touches on energy, on food, on health, migration, education, inequality, culture, and the production of meaning. And what we're sort of seeing is the breakdown of a form of life that has become unsustainable. You can call it globalism or extractive capitalism, or, you know, some call it neocolonial modernity. And what we need to also understand is that this sort of civilizational breakdown or these ontological wars that I'm describing, create a condition where those who want to benefit from these disruptions, and I would think that it is the right, the far right, they really know it very well. You know, sort of the new intellectual right, the Silicon Reich, the techno-authoritarian class, as you want, they understand the moment quite well. But their solutions, they're terrifying. You know, they want to close borders. They want to hoard resources. They want to dismantle democratic governments and crush any form of dissent. And they also want to privatize what's left of the commons. So their planet is libertarian, authoritarian, and in a way, it's even more terrifying. It is terracidal. You know, it wants to destroy the earth. Yeah? And what they know best is how to crush liberal democracy, to implement a very cynical and very brutal form of oligarchy. And we see that happening quite everywhere. Chillingly, unfortunately, their vision resonates more and more with younger people, yeah? People who are frustrated by the status quo and are drawn to political leaders who pretend to represent somehow this idea of the silent majority, no? And this is, I think, the reason why a real transition or transformation, so not only sort of a market-friendly greening of our energy system, but the shift in existence itself, you know, is so urgent today and at the same time so contested. But I think there are possibilities, and you know, we should not be disheartened, and we cannot afford to be disheartened. We must remain clear-eyed. But we must also reckon that ecological programs cannot be reduced to just solely, let's say, emission targets or biodiversity metrics. We must really collectively confront the deeper convergences of these sort of anti-democratic politics and the economic fragility that comes from it, the climate disruptions, the inequalities and the social atomizations that I've been talking about. And here I want to refer to the political thinker Nancy Fraser, who has called for what she names trans-environmentalism. So it's a form of environmental ecological thinking that aligns ecological aspirations with larger societal and political struggles for transformative justice. So only it's a form of justice that is not so much based on politics, but on the many faceted cultural intelligences that we can bring together. No, the sort of weaving of the academic, of the scientific, of artistic, of activist, ancestral, and truly versatile, really different forms of knowledges and practices. And if I say cultural intelligence, I also want to say that we need to be aware that culture is very much under attack today, you know, at the same time as the sort of ecological and environmental transition is under attack, because culture is seen somehow and very easily put as the source of evil of our division. And this is happening both on the left and on the right. So culture has become somehow the culprit, no? It is blamed for identity politics and its excesses. But I believe that we as cultural workers have to be aware of and very attentive of not to lose the capacity of culture to forge connections, not to be sort of also the motor that challenges hegemonic narratives and that is able to foster alliances that are crucial in this moment of ecological and transitional kind of forms of justice that we're sort of hoping to achieve. If culture is only sort of seen as the battlefield for identity and politics, yeah, we risk forgetting that it has an important role as a catalyst for systemic transformation. And so I think that the task that falls to us as cultural workers, and by that I mean artists, and I also mean scientists and activists, designers, and I mean people who are actively seeing their role professionally, but also individually, to contribute to a sort of cultural and transformative change. So our role is to somehow reinvigorate ecological transformation, not as a technological fix, but as a part of this sort of civilizational transformation that I was talking about. Yeah? And one that keeps mobilizing broader civic and cultural movements for the regeneration of life. Yeah? And if we are somehow sort of, invested in these practices of what I would like to call planetary consciousness, a way of healing and caring sort of for the web of life and the different bodies and places and communities that sustain life, we must find these forms of connection, and we must actually create practices that are again becoming sort of life affirming, no? In the way that we are relocalizing our productive activities, that we recommuning the broken fabric of our world. And it also demands sort of reimagining a little bit who we are as humans, no? Especially for those who are so much attuned to the comforts of the Western liberal world, no? And we must find an idea of the human that sort of reaches beyond the one of the sort of economical human, the homo economicus, no? The sort of self-serving individual that is at the heart of, at the center of growth and progress. We must learn to let our exceptionalism, disappear again and embrace a form of planetary solidarity. And the moment is it's a difficult one, but at the same time, we have seen in the past 20 years how many people have gone to the streets to demand and fight for societal and structural transformation, and they're more than ever. So these political movements, they have been weakened and often brutally shut down, but we cannot afford to be frustrated or cynical. No? The time is now to keep weaving the transition from below. We must align and find ways for alternatives, and they exist. They are there. We must align with them. No? We cannot delegate our life forms and our futures to experts and to the global markets or to a system that is really not able to sort of move beyond a status quo. So for me, I would say transition means reclaiming again these capacities and to disrupt the war against everything that is collective and communal, and really to design and to think a planet in transition that somehow gives us the capacities to affirm and to think about life after the system that broke it. And this is really where I see my place.
Thank you, Daniela, for addressing the scope of the crisis we're facing, one that is, as you suggest, truly civilizational. Your reflections on the anthropological war, techno-authoritarianism, and the brutal forms of oligarchy that we're witnessing feel especially urgent. And your reference to Nancy Fraser's concept of trans-environmentalism speaks directly to the interconnected nature of these challenges. In your book, The Laughter of the Jellyfish, you introduce the notion of counter-research and counter-knowledge. Could you elaborate further on what you mean by these ideas?
The idea of counter-research and counter-knowledge in my work stems in a way from the concerns that I've been outlining. But beyond that, I've been very critically thinking about how knowledge systems, so not only artistic forms of knowledge, but everything that counts as knowledge, yeah, how these knowledge systems are enmeshed in a worldview that has been dominant over many, many centuries, but seems highly inadequate today in facing our world. And I've come to realize that many, many artists, many writers, scientists, and, you know, just cultural workers, as I've called them, find themselves exhausted and really breathless, some of them even enraged, in the face of ideas, of old ideas, I would say, and outdated concepts that restricts very much what we can think and what we may articulate. No? So it's this idea of a frustration that we're using knowledges that are, on one hand, old and inadequate to actually understand where we are currently, but also think beyond the status quo. And maybe to unpack my argument a little bit, we might start with the question by asking, what do you mean by knowledge? No, what is the knowledge that we're sort of seeking in the face of the kinds of transformations that we've been talking about just in the first question you asked me? And knowledge is a really fickle thing. Yeah? We cannot really qualify it or quantify knowledge. No? So is more knowledge better than less knowledge? You know, what is good knowledge, for instance? Yeah? We undeniably live in an era of unprecedented knowledge production with extremely efficient technologies for generating and disseminating knowledge. But the real dilemma here is, and one that for me is crucial, what matters is clearly not simply the amount of knowledge, but its kind, its use, its context, its validity, no, for flourishing and supporting the life of people. So we ask in a way, is knowledge produced to better understand the world, or is knowledge produced to dominate the world or to regulate the world? Is knowledge there to broaden our perspectives, or is it there to reinforce existing worldviews and to sustain a particular political or economical status quo? And this is an old question, right? It's one where a lot of feminist thinkers have been and indigenous thinkers have been helping us to sort of tackle them. But I think we need to always keep in mind that knowledge itself, no, has this sort of, let's say, ambiguity that we must be constantly keep reminding ourselves. So much of the knowledge that we have and that we're using is what Erich Rogoff calls inherited knowledge. So inherited knowledge is part of our DNA. So every people, every community, every civilization, if you want, has form of knowledges that are being passed down from generation to generation. And we're not even questioning it anymore because as I said, it's so much part of who we are, how we define ourselves. And in a way, science is a very good example for that, no? Because what counts as scientific knowledge must be scrutinized and it goes through sort of peer reviews, and it's considered solid knowledge because it's very durable and it's built on its relation to evidence and to falsification. Yeah? So it's a positive aspect. So inherited knowledge is not just something that we need to critique, right? It's something that we need to acknowledge. Yeah? There's a form of solidity in there on which we can build. But to come back to sort of, for instance, the idea of scientific knowledge, science is not only built to endure, it also reproduces and protects its knowledge base. Well, it means that knowledge is also very often tied to the idea of property. Yeah? And what does that mean? It means that individuals or individual research is privatized through patents and copyrights, Well, other forms of knowledges, for instance, collective knowledge or ancestral forms of knowledges, yeah, indigenous, non-Western knowledges, they remain open to appropriation and exploitation. So there's a very instrumentalist understanding to knowledge production that seems very normal to us, yeah, normal to the way we sort of disseminate and reproduce knowledge today. So we expect knowledge to serve a very defined purpose. So we expect knowledge to, for instance, improve productivity, no, to advance technology. And that's a very positive orientation, which often suppresses and sidelines other forms of knowledges. And I've talked about them, no, like indigenous and non-Western forms of knowledges. So what I'm claiming is, and what, where I start from, other than just sort of questioning what knowledge is to, I'm claiming that it's essential not only to examine knowledge itself, but also to look at its shadows, at its blind spots, not everything that has been invisibilized. So other ways of knowing and doing, sort of non-European knowledge, the knowledge of women, the knowledge of animals, of the material world, of the oceans, of the geos, and so much more. Yeah? So there's really a thousand other ways of knowing and building worlds, if you want. And many of these forms of knowing have been eclipsed for a very simple reason, because by rendering them invisible or irrelevant, they are also made exploitable or expendable. And in a way, this brings me to the Anthropocene. And why the Anthropocene? Because in a way, this is a very important proposal. It's a very important way of sort of framing our current moment. Yeah? It's not just a geological era, but it's actually something that marks a shift in knowledge, a shift or even a rupture in the way we understand the earth, we understand the continuity of life in earth, in the way we understand actually our relationship to the planet. So if we're entering a new epoch, a new planetary epoch called the Anthropocene by some, the Capitalocene by others, or the Plantationocene. So if we're entering an epoch that is fundamentally different and one that is shaped very much by human activity, we're also confronted with the question, what does this mean for how we understand ourselves, our histories, our knowledge systems, our political structures? And in a way, the world epoch, right, which is being used to describe the new planetary era in which we are, is very interestingly, in its Greek roots, it doesn't just signal not a long stretch of time as we're understanding it, but at its root, the epoch is the turning point. It's the point in which, you know, we are sort of moving from one era to the other era. So if we're entering a different era, yeah, of the planetary conditions, we also need another era, if you want, of knowledge production. So this leaves us, in a way, with a profound crisis of knowledge production, and a crisis that, in a way, must be answered, if you want, by cultivating forms of counter-knowledge, forms of knowing and doing that can challenge and resist and in a way also reimagine the frameworks we've inherited. And it's not just about tweaking existing models, yeah, but really fundamentally rethink how knowledge is produced, how it is reproduced, how it is distributed, and how we can actually, again, align to other forms of knowledges that have been eclipsed and have been sidelined. And counter research is fundamental for me, because it describes the search, the longing, the curiosity to understand the horizons of possibilities. It works against the grain. It works against established assumptions and methods, and against the restrictive and exclusionary access to data, to information, to resources, but also to the ideas that we need to understand and to sort of change the realities in which we exist. So for me, the opportunity is then for artists, but for other thinkers, to conceive of counter proposals, of counter propositions. As I said, not only as a critique of knowledge and institution, but really of acts of becoming, of acts of transformation, of becoming and seeing the world in sort of different ways, and to make space for a future that is not foreclosed, for a future that is productive, for a future that can be shaped by many people, for a sort of a pluralistic future. Yeah. So in short, I would say, what do we need? We need to unlearn many things. We need to understand many things. We need to abolish mechanisms that are not productive, no, to sort of develop new ideas. We need to resituate our approach to knowledge making. We need to reframe the project of world making as pluriversal and cosmopolitical. And we need a relational orientation towards non-human beings, no? Sort of constructing modes of subjectivity that acknowledge kinship, but also resist this idea of totalization, no? This idea of we're all the same, but allows us to sort of see the way the world is shaped by sort of many different approaches, aims, aspirations, and ideas for future.
Thank you, Daniela, for plunging into the deeper waters of our shared memory and the spirit of our time, illuminating the path of transformation that awaits us across all spectrums of knowledge and awakening. You work with a remarkable range of transdisciplinary artists and thinkers, such as Madison Bancroft, with Leo Landon Barrett, and Ais Pinay, Nabil Ahmed, Suzanne Winterling, Amar Kanwar, Armin Linke, Ernesto Neto, and the Huni Kuin, Alan Sekula, Jana Winderen, among others, whose practice you highlight in your book. How do you see their work shifting the gaze of the contemporary spectator? Can artists and cultural producers reshape our visions of the future? And should they be seen as key figures in advancing sustainable development from both social, political, and environmental perspectives? As well, considering how little we still understand about the ocean, how do we imagine reconstructing the ways we generate knowledge, especially as we confront the complex dimensions of the Anthropocene?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you again for the question. So first of all, I want to shout out to TBA21, the foundation I've been working for over 20 years, because it is really TBA21 that has given me access and the possibility of working with these amazing artists. So thank you, TBA, first of all. But then also, obviously, thanking the artist and their generosity for sharing their practices over all these years. And I've selected the works of these particular artists as case studies, because to me, they exemplify an approach to art and research that gestures towards the kinds of reconfigurations that we've been discussing. Each of the artists operates within what I would call different territories of research, no? Different environments, ecosystems, and ways of knowing and understanding, and different epistemologies, employing really diverse forms of artistic expression. Yet what unites their practices is a shared effort to reverse the gaze. Now, this is what also this idea of the counter research implies, reversing the gaze, challenging dominant perspectives, and in a way unsettling conventional ways of seeing, of asking questions, and of relating to their respective subjects. So through their work, these artists propose very different alternative frameworks that questions just the way how art can work in difficult circumstances, trying to understand, to approach, to give shape, to set things into relation. And that to me is extremely, extremely inspiring. So let's look a bit at the question of the ocean, because this is one of your main concerns. And I think maybe through the oceans, I can explain a little bit better what some of these artists have been doing. And here I want to start with the American artist and writer Ellen Sekula, whose work and film project, The Forgotten Space, it's a film that is called The Forgotten Space, has been very inspiring to me because it compellingly illustrates how the oceans, despite their fundamental role in sustaining capitalism, has been systematically rendered invisible, invisible in the public consciousness, but also in the really in the political discourse. And his work has exposed the hidden infrastructure of global logistics, revealing in a way how maritime spaces are fundamental in the reproduction of capitalism and its spatial and environmental dynamics. And he calls it the forgotten space because he says that because exactly and precisely because the oceans are so important, as a transportation network, where about 90% of all the goods and resources that we are consuming are transported over the ocean. And yet at the same time, this incredible transportation network is made invisible in public consciousness, but in also in environmental discourse, in order to be able to sort of hide these networks of connection. So in a way, this Ellen Sekula's very insightful understanding of the forgotten space has been a very deep inspiration for my own research and to look where others are perhaps not looking, to interrogate the conditions of visibility and invisibility and to make visible the entanglements of ecology, labor, and capital. So one can also argue that the oceanic space is paradigmatic of these processes of concealment and neglect that I've been also talking about in knowledge production, in a way how the oceanic space has become a scene of crime. And if you want to unravel a bit this idea of the scene of crime, we can sort of look at the anthropogenic transformations that are happening in the oceans. So basically, all the interconnected impacts of these transportation networks, of extractivism, of military securitization, but also of the degradation of life in the oceans. And I think looking at these various spheres, how the scene of crime of the ocean is taking place, really gives us a better understanding of the current state of the ocean and its future transformation. So coming back to Sekula, as I said, he's looking at maritime transportation systems and infrastructures. He combines, filmic works with photographic and archival research. He's produced a lot of critical writing and his practice, is sort of weaving together analysis, image production, but also textual work, in order to expose the sort of, what is underpinning sort of this global scene of crime. And I think in a way that's sort of one entry point that I'm following. Another artist, Armin Linker, again, is a photographer who works very closely in some ways with this idea of photographic documentation. I'm specifically interested how he's looking at, and that's also the name of the project that I'm discussing, prospecting oceans, how basically now the oceans are becoming, let's say, the last frontier of extractivism through methods of prospecting for deep sea mining activities. And we know that our moment and currently, this is a incredibly contested activity. No, deep sea mining is just being legislated, unfortunately, or very close to sort of final legislation that would allow the extraction of certain forms of mineral from the deep sea at a moment where actually the consequences of these forms of extractions are, from the side of the sciences, yeah, very much contested and seen as an incredible disruption to the deep seabed that is, you know, constantly portrayed as being lifeless, no, as being because it is so deep under the ocean that there is no form of life in the deep sea, which is absolutely contested. So Armin Linke has been approaching the deep seabed and been looking at these various forms of approaching deep sea mining by making interviews with artists, with scientists, with policymakers, with activists, in order to map out the physical and bureaucratic geographies, if you want, of extractivism. So that's, let's say, another area of investigation. Yeah? So we have the transportation networks through Ellen Sekula. We have deep sea mining, prospecting and extractivism in Armin's work. And then another really important case study for me is by Nabil Ahmed and his collective called Interpret. And they're addressing the question of militarization. Yeah. And here militarization through the atomic testing in the Pacific Ring of Fire that happened, you know, through French, American, whatever, but is specifically looking at the form of ecocide, at the forms of the devastation of ecological life world, right, through atomic tests, and how this actually is a crime against humanity. So he's blending forensic investigation and spatial analysis with activist scholarship. He's using different form of satellite images, legal research, environmental samplings to trace the ecological and human impacts of military operation, and especially the atomic tests that happened, you know, over decades in the Pacific area. So, in a way, his methodology is to look at the intersection of art, law, and environmental justice and really push the law towards sort of a new understanding of ecocide at the current moment. The last examples I want to give are through two artists that I've, again, deeply been involved with and whose work I've followed over a long time, and that is Susanne Winterling and Jana Winder. And both of them somehow take a different point of departure. If you want, they submerge themselves metaphorically and physically beneath the water surface. So they're not investigating it in a documentary way, but basically they are looking for an embodied, an effective way of understanding the oceans and life in oceans. And in a way, their work reveals how water itself and the aquatic inhabitants, or the fish and everything that lives in water, generate what I would call with a host of scholars, tidalectic forms of knowledge. Yeah, tidalectic is a term coined by Kamau Brathwaite, describing the ways of thinking shaped by the tides, no, by the cyclical movements of the sea, offering a very fluid and sort of non-linear way of the traditional forms of understanding dialectics. Yeah? So they have a tidalectic approach to ocean knowledge, if you want. And they want to cultivate, if you want, a particular mode of attentiveness and intimacy with the ocean and their inhabitants. Yeah? So they activate sensory connections to non-human entities, and they circulate narratives, yeah, that engage somehow with the alterity of water. Yeah? Alterity means their otherness, their alienness, yeah? And thereby emphasizing a sort of hydro-feminist ethics, yeah? A feminist ethics that is deeply engaged with bodies of waters and emphasizing the role of water in connecting all human lives, in advocating relationality, care, co-becoming between human and non-human bodies through the shared medium of water. Yeah? So again, that's a completely different approach. It's based on proximity, on practices of hearing. So Jana Winderen is a sound artist. Yeah? So hearing the fish, hearing also the sort of acoustic signals that emanate from all the life forms in the water, and how actually the acoustic sonority of these life forms is a way, it's almost like an aesthetic way of appearing in the space of water and a language, literally, no, that we must be attentive to. So if you want, these are very different methodological shifts now. So we have, you know, immersive field work. We have material translation. We have speculative fabulation and a lot of sort of collaborative co-creation that I would say, engaging with scientists, with activists, with local communities to produce what is being called sort of situated and plural forms of knowledges. So as you can see, there's very different methodologies for approaching the oceans. They challenge very traditional research paradigms, and they foreground sort of very different and relational dimensions of knowing. And that to me is so important. You know, I don't want to see any form of counter research or counter knowledge practices as something that can be reduced to a language that can just, you know, that wants to describe a certain specific methodology, but sort of opening up the possibilities and the different approaches for artists and researchers and thinkers, no? How to actually engage with the transformation of the worlds around us.
Daniela, a simple yet perhaps impossible question. Do jellyfish rule the world? I'm asking this not only playfully, but also in light of the way jellyfish emerge in your writing as ancient and radically other intelligences. You seem to place them in dialogue with our own anthropocentric collapse.
Not yet, but they might. They might reoccupy the oceans, no? If we keep disrupting the reproduction of life in the oceans. I mean, we know that the jellyfish are actually, you know, feeling quite well in these warming and acidic oceans that are currently in the making. Yeah, I mean, let's say, there's something really interesting about the jellyfish, because actually the jelly are medusas, right? And so one of the myths that I've also sort of been intrigued by, and I think one of the reasons I've chosen also the title for my book, is that one of the most lasting and most inspiring myths that we have is the myth of the Medusa. Yeah? And it's so rich and so symbolically layered, and it's constantly sort of coming back. Now, there are so many scholars that have been looking at the myth of Medusa, and I find that very intriguing. No? So why specifically the Medusa? No? Why is this sort of aspect of mythology sort of something that sort of keeps reoccurring in today's sort of imaginaries? And yeah, in a certain way, you know, if we think about the proliferation of the mythological, and at the same time, no, the proliferation of the real jellyfish, they might be very happy about sort of this new era that we're presented with.
Beautifully said, Daniela. Thank you for bringing us back to mythology and this millennial creatures to life itself. We live in crucial times. If a jellyfish could offer us wisdom, what might it say about the times we live in? And how do you envision the near future through your lens?
Well, I think jellyfish would tell us that the Anthropocene is not a distant future, but that it's already the condition of life of the present. I think they laugh at us, no, for being quite naive and unable to realize what is happening to the planet. I think that's what they might say. My personal outlook. Well, maybe I answer this question with the scientist Isabel, science philosopher Isabel Stengers, for who, in a way, the real catastrophe is that we're struck in a temporality, in a capitalist temporality where events keep happening, but we're somehow disallowed or disincentivized from really thinking their consequences through or for responding in transformative ways. No, we're somehow trapped in those cycles of reacting to emergencies. No, think about these constant crisis headlines. But these reactions are shallow. No, they do not allow us to engage with what really is happening and what these crises mean for the long time, no? For the kinds of transformation that are needed, or how to sort of genuinely respond to them. And that's, I would call it, that's a cognitive rupture that we are suffering through. No, we see the events, but we don't follow through their implications. Yeah? We are kind of only trying to confront what is happening in the immediate. And I think we are being called to rethinking the catastrophe as a rupture in time, no, not just as a future epoch, as the jellyfish would say, but one in which we already live, that has already occurred, is in the process of occurring, and continuously will occur. And so, out of that reckoning, it's an invitation to sort of forge new ways of thinking and acting in the world. And that's perhaps the most difficult thing for us humans, no? It's a form of temporality that resists being turned into very simple or actionable fixes. Yeah? Like, what's the solution? Maybe it's a reckoning that there is no solution, that there is only the possibility of understanding what brought us to this point, you know, what the story is, how did we get there, to understanding the contemporary moment in which we are, and to transform into futures where forms of livability with the trouble seems to be the only possible solutions we have.
Thank you, Daniela. We truly admire your practice and your viewpoint. Thank you so much for being here at Zeitgeist 19 and sharing your thoughts with us and everyone who's listening.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your kindness.
May we come to see, as the ancients once did, that even in the most feared figures like Medusa, there lies a hidden power of beauty, reflection, and rewilding. In this age we call the Anthropocene, where so much seems fractured and uncertain, transformation stirs in listening, softening, and remembering the truths our bodies and waters have always held. We are not merely surviving change, we are becoming it. Let this be a time not of endings, but of thresholds, of unlearning the petrified gaze and reimagining what it means to see with compassion and courage. The world is still becoming, and so are we.